to the council. Thank you for serving as a regent, and thank you for applying to be reappointed. For the next 45 minutes, we hope to have a discussion, and we'll ask many questions. But to get us started, I'd invite you to make an opening statement or some opening comments. And then also at the end of the time, we'll have a chance for some closing comments if you would like. So.
Well, first of all, thank you all for all the hard work that you do, and also, of course, for the opportunity that I have to be here with you and to be able to talk with you today. And for those of you who were here 6 years ago, and there are a few of you, I want to say a special thanks, because I have had the most meaningful, satisfying, challenging time, probably an experience of my life, being a regent. So it has been something that has been a wonderful experience, and I thank you, the people who did move my name forward 6 years ago. I want to talk about two things right away. One of them, are there any particular characteristics or roles that I have that seem to stand out, why it would be important for me to serve a second term? And the second thing I want to talk about is sort of what I feel are some of the important things to think about in terms of the university. So, first of all, on our board right now, we have somewhat of a balance, but not totally. And I think having a board where some members have been there for a second term and some are new with new observations and new eyes is very important. In 2 years, three of our elder statesmen will most likely leave the board because they will have finished their second term. And so I think that I could serve in that role as an elder statesman. I probably qualify for sure for the first part, and I hope for the second, and that would be important. Secondly, Eric Kaler and I became chair, and Eric became president at the same moment. And so we have established a relationship, I think, that is very frank, and it's honest, and it's collaborative, and it's congenial. And I think that's very helpful for a president to have somebody who he feels that he can have very frank conversations with. And I believe that it's one of my skills in the rare times, and they're very rare, when I disagree with President Taylor. I think I can say it in such a way that he hears what I'm saying. And the third reason that I think I bring something somewhat unique to the Board of Regents is I'm an educator. And it's interesting to me that often we look for financial wizards and experts, even though I did chair the audit committee the first 2 years I was on the board, thinking that we really need financial people. But I believe that our governance responsibility is both financial and also to make sure that we have a quality education in all areas. So those are some of the unique things that I think I bring to the board. And now I'd like to just mention a few of the things that I think are really important in terms of the university. One, I believe that one of the board's major roles is to support our president and make sure that he's successful. That does not mean blanket approval for whatever he does, but it means having honest conversations when we need to have them and to make sure that he's successful, because if the president of the university is successful, I believe then that it's a huge step in the right direction for the university. The next thing that I believe that the board really needs to look at, and we are, and we're in the process of this, is long-term financial planning. Now, that's such an umbrella because that includes things like tuition and differential tuition. It includes financial aid. It includes job classifications and looking at our HR system. But I do believe that long-range financial planning is extremely important. Another area that is of particular concern to me is our medical school. I believe rather firmly that to be a top echelon university, we need to have a top echelon medical school. And the university, many years ago, my husband actually graduated from the University of Minnesota Medical School. It was renowned throughout the country, and our medical school is still excellent, but it needs work and it needs improvement. And so that's a big interest to mine, the medical school and academic health center. Another thing is that we need to tell our story better. As I was mentioning to somebody outside, the university is so impressive and it is so complicated. And somehow, and Dan, you probably appreciate that too, we need to figure out ways to tell our story even better, and I think that's very important. And then the last thing that I want to mention is that I believe a cohesive and collaborative board, not meaning a board that doesn't question very critically things, but that a board that works well together is so helpful to the university. I have this theory called the trickle-down effect, and it's that if a board is working well, the president and administration works well, and then the faculty and students work well. And so in my mind, it is so crucial that the Board of Regents is a highly functional group. Now, I could talk about a lot of other things, but I want to leave lots of time for questions, and so I'm going to stop here.
We'll start off with Jerry.
Okay. I'm intrigued by your comments. To disclose, I'm a family doctor, so your comments about the academic health center are really appropriate. The things back in my days of training was considered, as you mentioned, one of the top institutions in the country. We see at least some publicity say that things are not as good as they were at one time. And so what do you foresee as things that we have to do to bring our position in the world of medical education back to where it was considered 30 years ago?
Well, one thing, and I think President Kaler is in the process of doing this, is that I think the question of the organization of the academic health center has been distracting for people, and there's been sort of a dual role, dean of the medical school and vice president for the academic health center. Whether or not, I think there are pros and cons whether you have for both positions, but I think a decision needs to be made and has been made for right now that those roles will continue together, with the role of dean of medical school being emphasized. But that question needs to be answered so that we can get on with it, so that we can make sure that the things that we are really doing well, and there are many things in the medical field that we are doing extremely well, we can continue to do. So that I think just having the structure lined up so that then we can move forward is an important thing.
Lois.
This question is not implying anything. Going to your point about long-term financial planning, there is a part of me that wonders when the lines will cross between business complaining that students coming out of higher education aren't attuned to the world into which they are going, and that they're spending a lot of money bringing them up to speed and the like, and free online education from institutions of the likes of Harvard and Stanford, and a flat world where folks across the globe can access those courses as well as our students here. I find myself wondering, technology will only be enhanced, the free access is likely to only grow. When will the lines cross and business will say, you know, we post positions with requiring such and such a degree, maybe we really don't need that degree. Let's find out what people have taught themselves and bring them in the door. We're going to spend Y amount of money on them anyway to train them after they come in the door. I wonder when, and I kind of think the word might be when, as versus if it will happen, and what that then means for institutions such as the University of Minnesota in preparation for that day or to stave off that day?
Yes. I have a couple different responses to that question. I mean, one of the things that I know that business has been asking for are some of the skills which aren't taught on these very, very large internet courses. Some things like how does one do on a team? That there are a lot of projects and that you need to be on a team and be able to work collaboratively with people. So there's some, quote, softer skills, which I think students can get and do get in a university setting. I also think that many of these courses are wonderful courses taught by the world's experts in them, and they can augment. I mean, they can mean that somebody doesn't have to take prerequisites and they can jump into a 200 or 300 level course. Having been a teacher myself, I suppose I'm reluctant to say that total online education is ever going to replace that personal interaction, not only with the professor, but with the other students in the class. Now, I realize that, you know, you're able to chat with some of these online courses and so interact with the students. But I do believe that there's some experiences that you get from the classroom that you aren't going to be able to get. And that business probably, they're already asking for some of these skills that you can't get online. Also, I believe that the university, with this new building that they have, the Science and Student Tech, SSTS-wide, that's the teaching that goes on there. And many of the courses are now hybrid courses where the students are getting the teacher has their course or their lectures online. The students do it in their dorms or wherever they want. They listen to these, and they come to class, and they interact with each other and with the professor and say, well, I didn't get this. Help me. You know, how do we brainstorm and solve these questions? So I do believe that a lot of education is going to move toward the interactive and hybrid courses. I don't yet see the day when it's going to be totally online.
There is value in experience gained. That someone that has not had an identical opportunity to experience has. If there were to be a change and there were gaps on the board, if you were not reappointed, what would those gaps be?
Well, I think, as you say, I mean, I think, again, I think it's important to get new people and new eyes and new observations on a board, but I also think it's extremely important to balance it with people who've had experience also. I will tell you, and I think, as having been a perennial student all my life, I'm a pretty, I learn pretty fast, and there is a lot to learn. I mean, I have a ton more to learn. And so the 6 years experience I think that I've had would in some ways be not utilized fully by not having that information and that experience on the board. Just some of what does governance really mean? I mean, how does one walk that fine line between I'm not operationally managing the university, I'm looking at policy, looking at oversight, and so on. So some of the experience that I've had would be lost. I'm not sure we have anybody else right now on the board who would call themselves an educator. Clyde Allen has been very much associated with educational institutions. But I think it's really important. I mean, the university is an educational institution. I think it's really important that somebody who cares deeply, as all board members do, but with a particular interest in education is something that's important to you.
Thank you. I want to touch quickly also on, I want to go back about 6 years. And you shared with us at that point in time the knowledge, skills, and attributes that you would bring to the role. And I'm interested in whether you feel that you have fully realized the things that you shared with us that day, in particular your ability to facilitate board discussions under conflict.
Actually, I think I've had wonderful opportunities to fully utilize some of those skills. And I do believe that one of the skills that I have is facilitating conversation. I think that I listen well. Sometimes I look at myself and I think, well, I'm kind of a fence sitter, because I can listen to one point of view and I think, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I listen to another point of view and I think, yes, that makes a lot of sense too. So I think I'm a very good listener. I think it helps enormously when people feel understood. Clearly, I think you're all aware of, we had a time on the board, we had a conflict of interest. And that was a really difficult, there were many, many different points of view on the board. And so I would say that I got to use every skill and then some that I had in order to help people express their point of view and what they thought, and on all different ranges, then come to a decision about what I thought was the appropriate path to take, then try to engage everybody on the board to help them see that that was going to be the appropriate path also. And then I did appoint a three-person committee to help with that process. But I believe that, and many people, many legislators even said, that was really professionally done. I mean, we did it in a way we felt that was fair and professional. And so I do feel that I've had opportunities in other times to use some of those skills of having a highly collaborative board. But I believe right now our board probably has more divergent opinions on things than we've had in a long time, which I look at as very healthy. It's very healthy to have people express different points of view. But we also can listen carefully to each other, understand what the other person is saying, and then come to a decision. So thank you for asking that question.
Well, thank you for your service.
I'm Paul.
Hello, neighbor.
Yes, right. I've changed from my walking clothes.
As you know, we have an open position for the at-large student regent. So in your 6 years of board service, can you tell us how you have viewed that position and how it's helped to bring the divergent viewpoints and to have a more full-functioning board, to have that seat and that voice formally as a member of the group of 12.
I really appreciate having a student regent on board. I think it's very important, and I will speak to my good friend Maureen Ramirez. We came on the board together, not knowing each other, and we've become very, very good friends, and I have the utmost respect with the kind of maturity and thoughtfulness which she served on the board. And I think that a student point of view is extremely important. After all, we're about students. And so I appreciate that and think it's very important. I do believe that we also have voices of students as their student reps on each of our committees. That's very different from being a student regent. But a student rep sits with each committee, or two of them actually, and can voice their opinions and so on. So I feel that there actually is more than one student voice heard, there are also the student reps. And that's why, for me, I think it's sufficient to have one student regent.
Margaret.
Commercialization of research is a big topic across the country. It's seen as a futuristic revenue source. There are some universities that are way ahead of the University of Minnesota. So my question to you is three-part. Where do you think we are today? Where do you think we're going? And how is that going to happen?
Yes. Well, technology commercialization is a crucial item, and I believe President Kaler has recognized that. So where are we today? I can tell you that there were 12 technologies that were moved into some sort of commercialization this year compared to 3 or 4 years ago when there were two. Mm-hmm. So there has been Vice President Mulcahy, who has now retired, was very, very interested in moving the process and helping the process. So we now have made it simpler for business. There's a standard contract that doesn't need enormous sort of back and forth with university lawyers and business lawyers, where we can make an agreement with the business that if they want to let us do research on a particular aspect of something, that they can then commercialize that, and they've made, I don't know, the precise agreements, but if it just, you know, went over the top, the university would benefit from that too. So that it's the path for technology commercialization is much easier than it's been because we realize we want to work with business. Where is it going? It's definitely going in that direction. And I believe that the person that we just hired as the vice president for research, who's come from Texas, this is one of the areas that he's very knowledgeable in. And so it will definitely be an emphasis. And so that's one of the ways that it will happen. And another thing is that actually I believe Vice President Mulcahy was at a conference explaining about this new type of contract and what the university is doing, and then Harvard called and said, could we know more about this in depth? So I think we're on the right track.
David.
Thank you, Chair Cohen, for being here and, again, for your service over the last 6 years and for the future. From your perspective, I imagine that you're looking ahead at the future legislative session, which started at noon today, with wonderment in your eyes and thinking that you have a new budget before the university has a new budget for state requests. And while that budget is going to be not as robust from the state standpoint as it had been, say, 10 years ago, the issues of funding at the University of Minnesota is going to continue being a challenge, I'm sure, as it has been for you over the last 6 years. In your next tenure, if you were to be reelected by the legislature, is there something in that funding request, something that you want to fund at the university you think is so strategically important to the university that you will fight for?
Well, there are probably two things in the request that I would really fight for. One, and as you all know, for our students and families, tuition is a major problem. And so one of the requests is that we would make an agreement with the state that if they would pay us $14.2 million each of the 2 years in the biennium, that we would hold tuition for in-state, for the residents, undergraduates, at 0% increase. I think that's a really important direction to go in, something we care deeply about, and so that's one of the things I would fight for. The other is there's an $18 million request in for research, and the four areas of research are research that the university excels in and that is really attuned to the business of the state. The areas are, one is water, sort of conservation of water. It's conservation and water and how we can do, how we can keep our water pure. Another one is neuromodulation. Our neuroscience department in the medical school is superb. All these neurological things are really crucial. And so that's another area of expertise that we're asking, that we would like to emphasize. Another, the third is robotics, sort of robotics and manufacturing, which is, again, another area that's so crucial to the state. And let's see, I came up with the fourth one. Soil. Food. It's not, the water and soil are combined. It's food. And because we, on the... food has always been a major part of our agricultural school, and just both food supply and scarcity of food is something that we do well at the university and study. And also, of course, Minnesota with many companies such as Cargill and others, which are food related. So each of those areas of research that the university already excels in and could do even better really tie specifically to some of the businesses that we have in Minnesota. And so I would fight very hard for that $18 million to augment our research in those areas.
Thank you.
George.
Ms. Cohen, Regent Cohen. First, I think that's an excellent solution, what you just said about tuition. Make an agreement with the state, no increase for 2 years if they'll fund this. Great. I hope that it goes for you. You certainly have students in the state supporting that position. But my question, you said in your opening that you get along very, very well with the president, Mr. Kaler. And yet one of the principal duties of the regents are to evaluate the performance of the president. You've had the opportunity now for some years to do that. What criteria do you use to evaluate that performance?
We have certain markers that the Board of Regents put forth that we think are important. And I'll give you a couple examples. One is something that is very important to the Board of Regents because we feel it's very important to our students and our families, and it's a financial cost saving, is our four-year graduation rate. And that has gone, now the four-year graduation rate is at 58%, which isn't wonderful, but 5 to 10 years ago it was at 41%. So we're very much moving in the right direction. The six-year graduation rate is at 75%. So one of the markers, we would say, is we feel that graduation rates need to improve. I'm trying to think of what other specific markers. The research dollars are one of the things that are extremely important at the university. And right now, I believe we have somewhere between $750 and $8 million worth of research that the university does. It's something that we want to make sure keeps growing. It's going to be difficult because the federal budget is not, NIH and so on, budgets are not growing. And so when you apply for a grant, it's becoming more and more difficult. But that would be another marker. We would measure the president really on our three legs of our mission. One, what's happening with research. Two, the education, the teaching and learning. And one of the markers for that is graduation rates. Another would be first-year retention. Our first-year retention is now phenomenally at 91%. I believe 2 years ago it was 91, maybe last year it was 89%. That's huge for our university, where we hadn't always retained our first-year students to that degree. So the students is the second, and then our outreach, because the outreach is very important to the university, too. So those would be the three areas that we would evaluate the president.
Thank you. Thank
you. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your service, Chair Cohen, for your 6 years, but particularly for your chairmanship here, which was not the easiest year for some of those, for some reasons you've just spoken of. So I'd like to not pose a question, but ask you for advice in Paul Taylor's method. This group, you know, you 6 years ago, you went through this two-step process. We winnowing this RAC, winnowing the candidates, and then the legislature deciding the final outcome. What would you tell us, and then you've seen two classes since that came out of this process, and it's different every year. It changes with the winds. What would you advise us? What good advice could you give us as we come up with our shorter list? And what should we be cognizant of, and what do you think the important things are that we should pay attention to so we can give the legislature the very best opportunity, but most importantly, the university the very best chance to have the very best regents? Give us a little of your perspective on how you can inform our decision.
Okay. Well, thank you for asking. One of the things that I believe is very important, because it's very important to the university, is diversity. And so one of the things that I think as you decide which names you're going to move forward, I think it's going to be very important that there be diversity, and that is in many different areas, not merely gender diversity, but also ethnic diversity, a variety of things. So I think that's an important. Something that's very hard to ascertain, I think, is the not using being a regent as a stepping stone. I think that the people who want to be regents ought to want to be regents because they want to serve the university and serve the state, rather than think of it as, well, if I'm a regent, and then the next step is something else. Now, how one figures that out and discerns that is not easy, but I think how you get at what is the motivation to do this. Is it a love for education, a love for the state, for the university, whatever? I think that's really important, too. So those would be two of the things that would stand out for me. Again, as I said in my opening remarks, and this sounds a little self-serving, but I do believe that it's important to have some continuity. Clearly, we're not going to have, and I'm not saying it should be, even if it could be, which it can't, total continuity, but I think some experience balanced with new perspectives and new eyes and new observations.
Thank you for that, and I might just say that we here feel we probably were part of the making your year difficult, so we'll try and do better in the future.
I'm going to follow up on the diversity question. And we were challenged earlier today with a question about why is diversity important? Why is it important to you?
Well, it's important to me because I believe that so much in different points of view. I think whenever one can hear points of view which are different from the ones that you have, that I have myself, that it's enriching, that it allows one to think about things that they haven't thought of before. And so what I believe that just being able to hear ideas from people who have had very different experiences can bring a whole new light to a discussion. I've also read some research, and this is why I believe that diversity is so important on college campuses, is that students who have diversity on their campus make lifelong friends because that they're at a stage and an age where they do this. And so it's extremely important, not only from the intellectual and academic point of view, where you get just more stimulation, but also just the enrichment for each student is diversity is very important. And one of the things that I think the university is doing a really good job in that we have about 20% of our students are minority students. However, when you break that down, out of the 5,500 students who were first-year students coming in September, we had 175 African-American males. Now, that's not enough out of 5,500. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. I mean, our K-12 schools maybe aren't preparing, whatever. But it's an issue, and we need to address it.
It's scary.
Sonia.
Regent Cohen, we talk a lot in this country about the lack of preparedness on the part of a lot of students going into college and the work that needs to be done immediately and in other ways. Given your extensive K through 12 experience professionally and as a governance person, what would you say are the strongest links that the university can make with K through 12 education? And how can we strengthen, if we're already doing something well, how can we strengthen it even more?
Yes, that's a question that, of course, is of great interest to me because, as I think all of you or most of you know, I also serve on the Wayzata School Board, and I love that perspective of sort of pre-K through higher education. I think it's extremely helpful. And there are ways. The university has a program called Ramp Up for Readiness, and they have brought this program to many, many school districts over the state. And one of the things that it does is brings the idea down to middle schools that students need to be thinking about post-secondary education, not when they arrive at ninth grade and have to pick out what they're taking, but start in sixth grade to think about, and I'd even push it to elementary school, fourth and fifth grade, start thinking about, I want to go to college or some sort of post-secondary technical school, whatever it is, because our job market is going to be such that students who only have a high school education are going to not be equipped for the kinds of jobs. So that's one thing that the university is doing already. Another thing that the university is involved in is that there is a program. It's first started out being called STRIVE, but it's now called Generation Next. But it's a program to look at how can we really put our best minds and our best effort at closing this achievement gap. And they're starting with Minneapolis and St. Paul. They're not doing the outlying suburbs yet. But there are lots of little pockets, charter schools and so on, that have done pretty well at closing the achievement gap. But they're little spots, and we need some concerted effort. And the university is involved in that also.
A transformational change occurred in December. And I think very few people would know about it. And that is in private philanthropy. The two extremely powerful, independent boards that really rival the Board of Regents, they do, the Minnesota Medical Foundation and the University of Minnesota Foundation. How did that happen, and what role did the Regents play in this? I would never have thought I would have lived to see this.
You're right, and it is monumental, and it is so important, I believe. I could explain that there was a meeting of the University of Minnesota Foundation Executive Committee, and under very sad circumstances, we've accepted the resignation of Steve Goldstein, who has done such a wonderful job. And at that meeting, there was a discussion about maybe this is the opportune moment to bring up the idea of a merger. And people thought very much the way you did, said mm-hmm. that These were two boards. The Minnesota Medical Foundation has been in existence for 75 years, the University of Minnesota Foundation for 50 years. They had people who cared deeply about each of those foundations. And the conversation was going sort of, no, this would be way too hard, and so on. And I'm really not patting myself on the back, but I said, this is the opportune moment. And do we want to take advantage of it or not? And it did move the conversation to a different direction, and then, of course, the other people in the room had to latch on to that and so on, and then talk to the executive director of the Medical Foundation and the chair of that foundation and so on. But I happen to have been, because of my position as chair of the board, on both executive committees, the Minnesota Medical Foundation and the University of Minnesota Foundation. And I have huge admiration for the members of the Minnesota Medical Foundation who are willing to really move their operation in and join it with the University of Minnesota Foundation. I know it was on President Kaler's top items, and I think he really facilitated it with the executive directors, Steve and Becky Melkerson. He really helped move things along enormously. But I have great admiration for the people who are giving up a long heritage and history, and it is really, I believe, in the best interest of the university.
Curie.
A question on different note than we've talked about. Actually, part of your university that, in my view, gets the most press, has the highest paid employees, that being intercollegiate athletics. Maybe tell me what pages I read in the paper, but I think they get the most voice out there for the university. Mm-hmm. What's your viewpoints on how it fits in with the entire function of the university?
Well, speaking, I couldn't believe when my husband was watching the Arkansas Notre Dame
Alabama.
That's how close I'm. I was reviewing my notes for today, but anyway, and the coach was getting $5 million per year for. Anyway, you know, my own perspective is that I do believe that somehow the salaries of coaches being higher than two or three times what a president of a university gets, something's a little out of whack in our society. However, that being said, I believe that Gopher Athletics is definitely a window to the university for many people. They care deeply about it. I'm sure if those of you who were here six years ago heard the story about my father in football, because he was a Gopher football player, and I grew up on that. So I do believe that sports are very important. I think the student experience and the student athlete, that's a very important experience. And in this day and age, I just think it's something that we really need to have. And I think it can bring a lot of good things to the university.
Can I just follow up on that? Thanks for bringing that up. I don't know if the regents or anybody can influence the media, because they're the ones that, you know, you said, how do we get the story out about the university better? Unfortunately, a lot of it is always, you know, tainted because of what happens on the athletic field. At the same time, they don't do here now, like the University of Minnesota women's hockey team. We're national champions, 20 wins in a row, and you don't see, you know, it might be on page four that big. So I don't know, you know, what can, if anything, can the regents do to try and influence some of that in some way?
Well, I think we can definitely say and indicate to the president and to our PR people that we really would like, you know, more information on some of these teams that are doing so well. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't have to just be the football, basketball, or men's football, basketball, or hockey teams.
Right.
We are nearing the end of our question period. We do have a couple more questions that we may run a few minutes long here, if that's okay.
But, fine.
Jennifer.
Pleasure is.
Well, Linda, again, thank you for your service. And I wanted to delve deeper into the latest, another transformational change, which is that the position that Dr. Rusty Barcelot held, which was vacant for a while. A lot of us in the community were concerned, but there's a new staff, right, a new leader, the Vice President of Equity and Diversity. I believe she's from a Southern institution.
Yes.
And her name escapes me. I'm interested, since some folks are asking for information about kind of the inner workings of the university, I'm really curious, what is the benchmark then for the success of that position and under Dr. Kaler's leadership? How will you measure success in that area of equity and diversity?
Well, I think we want to, one of the things is that as we look at the population of our state, which I believe is 16% or something, if I'm close, you probably... But anyway, that we want to be sure that the university is reflecting at least the population of our state in our students at the university. That would be one measure. Also, but it's not only having the students at the university, it's the kind of experience that they have, to make sure that they have the kind of experience that it's something that they appreciate, that they feel included, that they have the courses they want, and so on. So that's another area that I think is very important. And so those are a couple of the ways, I think, that I would think.
And then also, a little follow-up. You're also losing... Go ahead.
One more. The faculty. I know that's a major concern of our provost, that we want to make sure that we're reflecting our student body and our faculty, and I don't believe that we have as many faculty of color that we really would like to have.
Yeah, and I was going to mention the loss of Robert Jones going to another institution as well.
Yes. And as you know, Rusty Barcelona was a vice president, so in the top leadership team. Then for a while there was, we didn't have a person, the person who was a director of equity and diversity was not a vice president or in the top leadership. And now the person coming in will be a vice president and in the top leadership group because we feel it's very important.
George. Did you have another question, George?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Can't read my own writing sometimes. So. Well, with that, I think we will conclude our questioning. Invite you to make a closing comment if you'd like. But something else I'd like to invite you to do is there something that we should have asked you? And if not, that's fine. But if there's something that you would, something else you'd like us to know, certainly include it in your closing comments.
Okay. I can't. You've done a lot of good questions, so I can't think of anything that you should have asked me. But I would like to make just a comment or two, a brief comment or two. I think one of the things that has meant the most to me is one of the regents came up to me, one of our relatively newer regents, not the very newest, but one of our newer regents, and said to me, Linda, one of the things I like most about your leadership is that it's not about you. It's about what's really in the best interest of the university. Now, that in and of itself, that's a judgment call, but I felt very good about that, that for me, this is something that I can put my heart and soul into. I love the university and the state and so on, and it really isn't about me. I try to do the best job I can. However, it is about an emotional attachment that I do have to the university. And this goes in back to both my mother and dad were first-generation college students at the university, and I mentioned this, I think, before, but I wouldn't be around because they met each other at the university and had some kids. My brother and son both went to undergraduate here at the university in economics. My husband, as I mentioned, has got his MD here at the university. As you know, I have both a master's and a PhD here at the university. My daughter, instead of spending her junior year abroad from Wellesley, came here to the university for her junior year because, first of all, she thought the economics department was so sensational and just wanted to be here. And then I'm stretching things a little bit but making a claim that a granddaughter who's at Cal Berkeley did spend last semester here at the university and loved it, actually. She is going back to Berkeley, however, but that's a fourth-generation Gopher. So I have a lot of loyalty for the university also. Just thank you all for, again, I know I was number 7 out of the interviews, and I thought, oh, my goodness, people might fall asleep. But I'm glad you didn't, and I appreciate all your questions and your listening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Great.